Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The White House announced this week it will end the nation's coronavirus public health emergency in May. California is doing it even sooner, ending its COVID state of emergency at the end of this month. But the virus is still very much part of our lives, driving ongoing concerns about emerging variants, long COVID, and the vulnerabilities of the immune compromised. That's what you told KQED when we asked for your questions and reflections about the impact of COVID in 2023. We'll hear those and more after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The Biden administration is letting the coronavirus public health emergency expire in May, and California is ending its own COVID state of emergency earlier on February 28th. So what does it mean to live with COVID in 2023? What are you wondering about or most concerned about now as we prepare to enter the fourth year of the pandemic? KQED's digital news team has asked our online audiences, who weighed in with a host of questions about what's on their mind and what they want to know. We'll address those this hour. Joining me is Carly Severn, Senior Engagement Editor with KQED News, who gathered the questions that are top of mind for you. Hey, Carly.
Hey, Mina.
And also with us is Dr. Peter Chin Hong to help answer those questions. Dr. Chin Hong is Infectious Disease Specialist at UCSF Medical Center. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Chin Hong.
My pleasure as always, Mina.
So I want to start with what it means that California and the nation are ending their COVID emergencies. There's been some worry from doctors and public health officials that people will interpret this as the pandemic is over. So if it's not that, how should we understand this phase?
Well, I think what it means is that we're landing onto Earth and we're not, you know, we're kind of floating down, we're coming down the mountain. We're not quite at the level of the sea yet, but I think it means that there will probably be less support for people. And, you know, in a fractured medical healthcare system, I'm worried that people are going to fall between the cracks. It'll be worse in some areas in the country versus others. In California, we are generally decently protected as a people compared to other areas. But there will be changes for people. And the biggest worry that I have is that it will be confusing. So if somebody wants to do a test, they just wouldn't know. They might just give up. Somebody thinks they might have COVID. They don't get that test, so they don't get access to Paxlovid. And then they'll be hospitalized, and those costs will be more than the prevention that they might have gotten. Somebody wants a vaccine, but they don't know what the copay would be from the insurance. Mm-hmm. They don't even know, you know, if it will be covered, and maybe it will be covered. So I think the patchwork medical system that we have would be amplified on, you know, May 11th, when this becomes no longer an official public health emergency. But like you said, Mina, it's certainly still very much around. And the worst thing that I want to have happen is that people think that it means that it's all over until next winter.
So do you think that this is not a wise move by the state or the feds?
Well, I think it is a wise move. It is the right time. They were kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. I think politically, you know, I think there was a lot of movement in Congress to stop it tomorrow. But I think this was a way in which there could be planning. You know, May 11th is some time away. Health systems could be prepared. And remember, health systems have been getting reimbursed fully for all COVID care. So now, you know, it will again be amplified where some ambulance is going to bring somebody to a hospital. The hospital is going to say, what insurance does the person have? If the person has no insurance or something that's not a PPO, they might say, why don't you go to that other hospital? And every delay in care in COVID is, you know, potentially a higher risk for doing poorly and even dying. So I think these are all repercussions that we have to be prepared for. So the country needs to have this roadmap and preparations. And I think that May 11th date is okay for that, and definitely better than tomorrow or next week.
Hmm. Well, thanks for sharing what you're looking out for, Dr. Chin Hong, and what concerns you. Because, Carly, your team surveyed our audiences to find out what they needed to know about COVID in 2023, and you got a lot of responses. First, I'm just curious what you were finding were the categories of things that were rising to the top for people.
Yeah, so the keynote, I would say, is confusion, just to echo what Dr. Chin Hong was saying. In 2023, folks feel like the kind of clarity of answers just isn't there anymore. They're being kind of told to make their own decisions, and I think that's why we're still getting questions from our audience. We're saying, what do you need to know? One thing that's coming up is, how do I know how bad COVID is right now in my community? Because previously in the pandemic, folks could like Google case rates and take a look of how many people were reported as having COVID. But now that people are doing so much at-home rapid antigen testing and not reporting that to the state, the case counts kind of don't give an accurate view. And so folks are wondering, well, how do I know whether it's cool to go to that indoor birthday party in the restaurant today? Like, should I be doing that? Folks have questions about wastewater, but they're not quite sure, like, as you know, a member of the public, how to look up wastewater in their community. So some practicalities like that. And also this indoor safety issue that Dr. Chin Hong touched on. Folks just really want clear answers about, look, how safe is it in the grocery store? Do I need the mask in Trader Joe's? Can I go to that birthday party in the restaurant? And finding no clear answers, I think they're coming to us and they're using their Google form.
Yes, it's interesting. As more people are going out in the world, going into indoor spaces, and not always masking and so on. In fact, I think that's more rare than it is common. We're all sort of noticing this and wondering to ourselves, how safe are these indoor spaces? People are going to more sporting events and parties and, of course, into schools and offices, taking much bigger risks than in previous years. And on that note, some of the questions that Carly received, Dr. Chin Hong, were things like, even though we're vaccinated, is it really safe to return to working in school classrooms? So this question is specific to schools. What would you say about how the schools are managing this?
So I think whenever I get questions like this, I always break it down into really trying to prepare your immune system as much as possible for whatever virus weather there is outside. So if you are up to date on vaccines, I think it's pretty safe in general. It all, you know, it depends on who you are and who you live with, but in general, you're going to be safe. And when I say safe, I'm not saying safe from an infection, but I'm saying safe from getting really, really ill. And I think it's really important for all of us to really distinguish between a breakthrough infection or an infection and something that makes you, your body really react dramatically and send you to the hospital or the ICU. And then with that setting, because if we have our goalposts as preventing all infections, I think we're setting ourselves up for failure. And the most important thing is that we do have a get out of jail card, which is Paxlovid. So for people, even if you're vulnerable and you get ill or infected after getting vaccinated, you can take Paxlovid to really reduce your risk further, not only of getting hospitalized, dying, but also of long COVID as well. So I think these are all the tools that people have. But there's a big coupling between testing and how you do, because you have to get tested to know that you have it so you can get prescribed Paxlovid.
Right. So stay up to date on your vaccination so that you are your best, your strongest immune, you have the strongest immunity that you can. If you're at high risk of getting very sick and you want to take additional preventative measures, I imagine that's a conversation with your physician.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I think if you're high risk, I really would recommend that people talk to their healthcare providers before so that they know what will happen if they do get infected. And we have so many things, again, not only Paxlovid, but molnupiravir, if you have a lot of drug interactions with Paxlovid. And, you know, 5 days is the general time period from time of diagnosis to when the medicines would work most efficiently. But there is a drug called remdesivir that we typically use for inpatients, but it's also approved for 3 doses as outpatients within 7 days in case you kind of miss the 5-day mark and you're worried about Paxlovid. And there are also other drugs coming down the pipeline. So I think these are all things that people need to prepare for, because you want to know who's going to prescribe it to you. Do you have drug interactions? Are you going to get blocked at the Walgreens because they're worried that you may be on other medicines that might interact with the drug? So I think having a Paxlovid plan really goes a long way.
And to the issue of getting accurate information that Carly told us about, here were some of the questions that the audience wrote in with. In order to check for virus risk in public, I used to monitor case rates, but now with home tests, unless reporting the case rate number does not seem to be a reliable indicator. I've heard that the results of sewer monitoring are more reliable. Is that true? Another listener wrote, I've heard that case counts aren't as accurate anymore. Where can I find reliable data to determine my own risk level?
Yeah, so that's a really tough question and something that even my colleagues ask me all the time, and there's no great answer. I think at the end of the day, what I look at really is, but it's really more of a distal outcome, meaning that it's a late outcome, but deaths. And if you look at that metric, we're not doing great. You know, we're, on average, about 500 deaths a day in the country. And I think I worry that, there is the people who are very much at risk, and the people, the vast majority are not at risk for serious disease. But, you know, we're becoming very numb to zeros and numbers. But that's a number that's a little frightening to me. But more proximally, you can look at certainly wastewater. But I know it's hard for people to interpret what that number means. But to me, it's more the shape of the graph and the way the curves are moving, because you know kind of what your baseline is. And generally, the wastewater shows that the numbers are moving in the right direction. But the deaths are still a little bit troublesome to me.
Yeah. So when we do look at the state publishing tracking data, the death metric is the strongest. And it sounds like the biggest value of the case rate data is the trend.
Yes, the slope of the graph. And of course, we can look at hospitalizations too, which is kind of an in-between. But of course, those hospitalizations account for people who have incidental COVID as well as those who are really sick with COVID. But I also look at the trend of that as well. And if you look at that metric, again, there's variation in region. San Francisco is doing generally decently because, at UCSF, we have fewer than 20 people, even with incidental COVID right now. Back in January of 2022, we had 150, 160. So, that is some cause for, comfort on some level.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF, and Carly Severin, senior engagement editor at KQED News. We're hearing from you, our listeners, about what you're thinking about in 2023 when it comes to COVID and its threat. What's your reaction to the federal and state government saying COVID's no longer an emergency? Do you feel relieved? Or perhaps you feel forgotten because COVID still determines a lot about how you live. You can email forum at kqed.org or post your thoughts on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Here's what we're talking about tomorrow: comic strips, specifically the history and power of LGBTQ comics. That's being highlighted by a new PBS documentary called No Straight Lines, all about what it means to be able to draw your own story. Today, we're hearing about what concerns you most about COVID as we enter the fourth year of the pandemic. KQED's digital news team asked our audiences that very thing, and you weighed in with a host of questions that we're addressing this hour. Carly Severn is senior engagement editor for KQED News, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong is infectious disease specialist at UCSF Medical Center. Join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post your thoughts on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Carly, on that KQED digital forum, you left space to allow people to tell us just anything they want to share about how COVID has affected their lives. I'm curious what kind of responses you got from people.
Yeah, because we knew there was a difference between having a very clear-cut question to ask versus kind of just wanting to share how you feel. And so we gave people the opportunity to do that, and they really did. And one of the keynotes that was really coming over was how isolating it feels to be kind of still living a different pandemic to other people, to feel like other folks are dropping restrictions, dropping the mask literally, but you still need to keep up your precautions. So that was a lot of comments that we got, just how lonely that felt. Also, when you're trying to keep yourself safe, but maybe a family member who might be immunocompromised, having to take all those extra steps just to make sure that you're not bringing the risk of infection in. And how navigating that right now in 2023 feels like kind of being on your own little island, and it doesn't feel good. So I was really quite struck with how many comments we had along those lines of how isolating this feels.
Yeah, this one struck me. I moved to a new city in order to provide full-time help with a relative's baby. It has been a socially very thin time. Staying isolated to keep the baby's bubble COVID-free has made it difficult to get acquainted. The fear of COVID was and is exhausting. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, you brought up the fact that we are seeing in January in the U.S. 500 people on average dying every day. In California, it's an average of nearly 40 people a day here. And we also did see people upset about COVID deaths, saying, will there ever be a time when COVID is completely gone? Should we get used to the idea that it's here to stay forever in some form? Why don't people care about the 300 plus Americans still dying every day? That was the stat prior to January. Do you have any thoughts on this? Is this a death rate that we are going to need to accept, because it seems we have come to accept it?
I think part of the acceptance, frankly, Mina, is that we're also tired and, we're declaring psychological victory because we want it to be over. And maybe 500 is not as bad as 2,000 or, it's like, the population of the deaths of 9/11 happening every day in those days. But 500 is still a lot. It's still, again, when I calculated it on my little iPhone right now, it's 182,500 deaths a year, which is way more than a typical flu season, which is 35,000 in a typical flu season. So again, it's troublesome to me and it's depressing to me because many of these deaths are preventable. Only 40% of those over 65 have gotten a booster, so we have that technology. In one study in the VA population, of those eligible to get Paxlovid, only 20% of those actually went out and were prescribed Paxlovid. So again, this is all leading to this death. We focus on unvaccinated as a risk factor, but we're seeing more and more vaccinated seniors. But back in December of 2020, when we rushed to have our grandparents and parents vaccinated, but it seemed that we've forgotten about them for that booster. And I was talking to my own mom who lives in New York, and she hadn't gotten a booster yet. And I was like, why? I've been telling you to get a booster all this time. And she's like, well, all my friends said, as long as you're vaccinated, I'm fine. And I'm like, no, you definitely need to get the booster. Every single database we look at shows at risk in those over 65 who are vaccinated but not boosted. And it's really a tragedy, both from the fact that we've become numb to zeros, and secondly, that we have the tools, it's for free right now, and people are not taking advantage of it. Mm.
Well, Kim has a related question to your point about not everyone getting Paxlovid. Kim writes, I tested positive for COVID with an in-home test in late November following a Thanksgiving get-together. I notified Kaiser because I wanted Paxlovid, but Kaiser only issues Paxlovid to certain patients. How is this possible?
Well, I think there's a lot of confusion about Paxlovid, and certainly the biggest bang for the buck in the studies is those who are unvaccinated and have at least one risk factor for serious disease, including comorbidities. So, but even in that population, people are not getting it. So there's confusion in the community, not only amongst the people, but amongst the people who are prescribing Paxlovid. Certainly, with President Biden, and Tony Fauci getting rebound from after taking Paxlovid, that made people more uncertain as to whether or not they would have any benefit. But the more we study it, it's very, very clear that there is a lot of benefit, but maybe not to the whole population. There's one study showing that for healthy people under the age of 50, that they may not benefit as much from Paxlovid as the wash. But I think California, and I remember Tomas Aragon making a statement a couple months ago, he's like, in California, you know, just assume you're eligible for Paxlovid, have that conversation. If you're being blocked, maybe ask someone else. Because again, it's better to have someone discuss it with you than for you to make your own decision. Hey, maybe I will be blocked if I ask, because a whole lot of people are eligible and would benefit from this. And I'm really coming back to that staggering figure of 500 people a day still dying in the United States.
Well, Daniel writes, I'm not pleased with ending the national emergency. People will stop using mitigation such as masking and social distancing. COVID will become business as usual. We're not at a point where we can pretend there's nothing wrong anymore. Carly, you heard from a lot of people who are immune compromised or live with someone who is. What was sort of the tenor? What were some of the things that were really bubbling up among those responses?
One thing I really noticed was how folks were saying it feels difficult to go back knowing now how I've been treated. Like, we saw that kind of comment a lot. I would love to read just one comment we had, because I thought it was so powerful. As a person affected by cancer, I'm saddened by the lack of respect for vulnerable people like me by the rest of the community. Wearing a mask indoors is not too much to ask. I already suffer from anxiety due to my oncological condition. COVID has added another layer of danger and fear to my life. And they talk about, you know, going to the grocery store and no one's wearing masks, having to be on BART because their employer is telling them that they have to be back in the office. And that feeling that no one really cares about them. That's a note that is coming up again and again in these comments. And it's really tough to read.
Yeah, there was another one. I have a severely immune-compromised husband, and we have lived very cautiously since the start of COVID. He has CVID and ITP, and getting COVID, especially before the vaccine was available, could have been deadly for him. But we live in a state that is anti-restrictions or COVID protocols. We just want to understand what our risks are. We do understand the whole thing about transmission rates, when they're high, etc., but it sure would be nice to know for sure whether we could be in congregate settings and feel safe. This is somebody who lives out of state. Another person writes, as an immunocompromised person with multiple health conditions, I am wondering when and how I can return to living in a way that is even close to how I navigated the world pre-pandemic. I had to be somewhat cautious even then. Do you hear this a lot, Dr. Chin-Hong? And what do you say to people living with chronic conditions that make them particularly vulnerable to COVID infection? At the same time, I'm also hearing a lot about this undercurrent of isolation in what they're saying. And I wonder what you say to people who are experiencing COVID-related isolation in 2023, when it feels like so many are out in the world.
So first, Mina, I would like to encourage everyone who's listening to be empathic to people out and about. And I know it's easy to think, wow, that person is such taking this with such overkill. They're double masking and COVID is really not much of a threat anymore. But remember, everyone you see has a very different circumstance. It could be that they're trying to protect someone at home. It could be that they're trying to go to someone's wedding, so they really can't afford to get infected at this moment. Everyone has their reasons. And, you know, just like we were empathic to each other early on in the pandemic, I think we need to return to that empathy and compassion. It's easy to say, but really hard to do when, you know, you're at the grocery store and you can't hear what the cashier is saying because she's behind a mask. But remember, people in the service industry are seeing hundreds of people every day, and they really need to protect themselves from their family too, even though it might be an infection and not serious disease, because they can't afford to stay home from work. So everyone has their own circumstance, so remember to be empathic. The second point I would say is that not all immune compromised states are the same. I know that we lump them into one box, but I think of it as a score of like 1 to 100, and most people are like might be 10 out of 100 in terms of how worried I am for them getting seriously ill. And many people with diabetes, for example, are really well protected if you're up to date on the vaccines. But I think we've lumped everyone in this category. It's not the same as someone who, say, gotten a lung transplant last week. They're much more at risk, or on chemotherapy that brings on their white blood cells. So having a good conversation with a healthcare provider can help stage what where you are on that spectrum of immune compromise. Because I've heard time and time of people, again, worried and being fearful, even though they may not be very, very immune compromised. And thirdly, I would say that, you know, there are sometimes things we can do in clinic to help reassure people. For example, although not validated, some clinics, particularly immune compromised clinics, transplant clinics, can measure your antibody response to the vaccines. That might give people some sort of comfort that they do have some protection as opposed to zero protection. And that might be helpful in the way you think about protecting yourselves and your family. And again, not to sound like a broken record, there is that get out of jail card. So having that Paxlovid plan, even though a lot of immune compromised people may be on drugs that interact with Paxlovid, there are ways out of that with adjustment to your drugs. And even if that doesn't happen, there are alternatives to Paxlovid to keep you safe, even if you are infected. And knowledge is power. So if you know about this, I think you can navigate the world a little bit more confidently.
Well, let me go to caller Alan next. Hi, Alan, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have kind of a complicated personal situation, and I'm trying to figure out how to navigate all this. I've recently had a stroke and pulmonary embolisms. So there's and I've had open heart surgery. I'm a mess. So there are a number of risks that are involved there. I'm double vaxxed plus the one booster, and I'm shy the last booster. Then along came all the variants, and I'm like, I've heard various things about the variants. One of which is it's much less. There's less morbidity, but it's much more. What's the word I'm looking for?
Transmissible.
The replication rate's much higher.
Mm-hmm.
The replication rate is much higher.
Yeah.
So there's a danger of it running out of control, especially for someone who doesn't have a response. So the problem, though, for me is that every time I've taken the three vaccines so far, each one has knocked me more and more and more on my butt. It's like really strong, the last one. So I'm like really concerned about taking this fourth one. Is there any way so I'm trying to mitigate risks and problems and things like that. What I'm wondering is there a way of getting the vaccine just for the variants?
You mean to try to limit the impact that it's having on Alan. Dr. Chin Hong, your thoughts?
Yeah, so, I mean, the new bivalent booster is a booster that's targeted to BA4 and BA5, which is kind of in the Omicron family. So it is, you know, tailored to these variants, not the specific ones that are circulating right now, but, you know, close relatives. Studies have shown from the CDC and others that they do provide better protection even against some of the circulating variants like XBB compared to the older vaccine. So I would say you are getting more benefit from the current updated booster, even though it's not as much as we expected. But again, it's going to really prevent that the bad outcomes. And in terms of your other concerns, Alan, and first of all, I'm sorry that you're navigating such a difficult medical situation, and I hope you get well soon, is that there is another vaccine for people who are worried about the previous reactions or just feeling terrible after mRNA vaccines. And Novavax has been approved as a booster. So it's an option. For example, I had a family member who had a really difficult cardiac complication, myocarditis after an mRNA booster. And he was over 65, and I said, and he was really nervous about getting that booster again with the bivalent booster. So I said, it's really important for you to be protected with a reminder, regardless of what that reminder is. So why don't you try Novavax? He went ahead and got Novavax, tolerated it really well. And I think that's an important option for people as well.
Well, Catherine writes, my 12-year-old has stage 1 chronic kidney disease. The early variants of COVID were shown to impact the organs, so we are still very careful. Will there be updated research soon on how much the newer variants impact the organs?
Well, right now, like Alan pointed out, the new variants luckily stick around in the throat more. They don't enter the body as much. And that's why, independent of vaccines and Paxlovid, we're generally seeing fewer people come up with chronic conditions or long COVID with these new crop of variants compared to the older variants. It doesn't mean people aren't, but it's a lower risk. And it speaks to the fact that the virus tends to be getting in the body less and therefore affecting the kidneys less. But you can mitigate the risk. And of course, hopefully your daughter has been vaccinated, because what happens in that vaccination setting is that even if the virus opens the door and enters your bloodstream and then goes to the kidneys, those T cells and B cells are going to kick the virus out. So it's going to stick around in the throat and not enter, affect other organs as much.
Kirsten wants to know, can Dr. Chin-Hong comment on the new FDA rule that a positive PCR test will no longer be required for a Paxlovid prescription?
Yeah, so you don't need a positive PCR test. You certainly, you can get an antigen test at home. In general, if people have a strong suspicion of, as a medical professional, I would say that you kind of want to make sure you have COVID rather than going through the whole 5 days of Paxlovid, because it's, again, 3 pills twice a day. You want to make sure you have COVID, but you don't need a PCR to do it. A rapid antigen test will do it. But I would definitely want to make sure I was positive before going through those 5 days.
We're hearing from you, our listeners, what questions are still top of mind for you as we enter the fourth year of the pandemic, and even as the state and federal governments prepare to end their COVID states of emergency. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can email forum@kqed.org. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. Also, just a note, our KQED COVID coverage and a Google form for questions is at kqed.org/COVID guides. Stay with us. We'll have more after the break with Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF Medical Center, and Carly Severn, senior engagement editor for KQED News. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. This is Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're taking your questions about COVID in 2023 as California prepares to lift its COVID state of emergency at the end of this month. We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF Medical Center, Carly Severn, senior engagement editor for KQED News, who's been gathering your thoughts and reflections about the pandemic over the course of these few years, and especially what's top of mind for you now. This listener writes, to Carly and to the KQED Digital News team. My daughter left UCLA and is back at home due to long COVID. I had to quit my job to help her baby brother with Zoom kindergarten. Now I'm afraid to go back to work because I have risk factors associated with long COVID, but my savings are running dry. Joining me now is Dr. Erica Pond, California State Epidemiologist and Deputy Director for the Center for Infectious Diseases at the California Department of Public Health. Dr. Pond, really glad to have you.
Always nice to be here. Thank you, Mina.
And there are a lot of people who are going through a lot, people with long COVID, people who are immune compromised, and people who are concerned about the state ending its COVID-19 state of emergency on February 28th. First, can you just tell us what's going to change on that day? What are the biggest changes that people will notice?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, the good news about this is that we've been thinking about and planning for this for many, many months. People may remember we kind of issued our state, what we called our smarter plan, you know, last spring, actually. And ever since then, we've been really working on, you know, how do we continue to adopt and manage this virus, SARS-CoV-2, in our lives. So we have a lot of tools now to really help us. You know, we have vaccination, these updated boosters. We now have much easier treatment that really helps kind of decrease the impact of COVID on our lives. So a lot of that, you know, we have now. I think some of the kind of governmental resources are going to transition to like more traditional healthcare. So, you know, it's kind of trying to normalize this as another part of the, you know, infectious diseases that we see in our community and in our healthcare setting.
But it will basically, the governor will not have the authority to issue orders and so on without the legislature. County health officials who are able to impose health ordinances and so on will need to seek the approval of elected officials. So things will move a little bit slower. Also, the head of the California Hospital Association told the New York Times that they felt February is a terrible time to end the public health emergency because they're actually seeing that hospitals are still beyond capacity, in part because of not just COVID, but pent-up demand for surgery and other treatments that people delayed over the years. What is your response to that?
A couple of thoughts. And one thing I actually want to clarify, as a prior local health officer as well, local health officers have local authority and are not dependent on elected officials for that authority. So, you know, if there are other, you know, public health emergencies, locals can issue health officer orders and sometimes do it on a much smaller scale. For example, an individual who might need isolation or quarantine for you know, multi-drug resistant tuberculosis is an example that's been used in the past. I think as far as the hospital capacity, you know, I think that is an ongoing healthcare system challenge. And certainly, as we've seen changes in our healthcare system and staffing and workforce shortages over time, I think that's just something that we're collectively our challenge with, but it is really clear that the burden of COVID specifically in the hospitals right now is decreasing and is a very small proportion at this point of hospital census. But I think what we're now challenged with is just, you know, the burnout and the workforce shortages that we're seeing, not only in the healthcare setting, but elsewhere. And this is definitely, and then the pent-up demand, it's sort of a double whammy in that sense. But I think the states of emergency and some of those state regulations that we had or exemptions we had to things are not going to necessarily address that problem. I think these are kind of longer standing problems we need to work on as a healthcare system.
Hmm. Well, let me go to caller Matt in Sausalito. Hi, Matt, you're on.
Oh, yeah. Good morning. Yeah, I just had a quick question about I've had all the shots and the last one was in the first part of September. So it's been about 5 months out. I'm just curious as to what we should expect for somebody, you know, over 60 for next year for an additional booster or whatever, or what's the plan for people who, you know.
Yeah, thanks, Matt.
In my situation.
Dr. Pond, we're getting a lot of questions similar to Matt. KQED's digital team also did as well with regard to vaccines, when people will get the next one, but also how the state is thinking about what kind of vaccine regimen we could see in the future.
Sure. And there was a federal meeting just last week of the FDA's advisory committee to look at this question. And they have started that discussion. And one of the main things they decided was more about, many people have heard about this updated booster and that it has two strains rather than one. So moving forward, the recommendation is to make all the doses that newer kind of two strains. And then I think they're talking a lot about the timelines for is this a fall sort of booster or update like the flu vaccine? So I think there's more to come for the federal recommendations, and we'll continue to closely monitor that. But it is looking more and more like, it'll be similar to a flu vaccine sort of update annually.
So based on what the feds say, the state will set booster schedules?
Yes. We are also, I think, just along those lines, for other vaccines as well, whether it's flu or, shingles vaccine, we follow the recommendations of the CDC and the FDA and have historically, and so we'll continue to monitor those. There's, a couple different advisory committees to the FDA and CDC, and then the FDA and CDC themselves issue, authorizations and or recommendations, and we definitely typically follow those and actually have not varied from those over the course of the pandemic.
Noelle tweets, how come we never hear about updating ventilation systems? How come paid sick leave proposals dropped? All the Biden administration wants is for the pandemic to be over and for Biden to take his victory lap. We're not all in this together. Carly, did you hear a lot of that among the audiences you surveyed?
A lot of disbelief that there weren't more mitigation measures being put in, yes. And this also kind of aligns with something I've been seeing on social media recently. You'll recall at Davos, when folks gathered, there were these photos of the filters, the air filters that were in every single room that people were meeting in at Davos. And a lot of people were saying, well, why don't I have this in my office? Why doesn't my kid have this filtration device in their school? And I think it really got people thinking and getting quite emotional and angry about the lack of care that they're feeling from their authority figures. So yes, seeing this a lot from folks.
In terms of ventilation systems or paid sick leave proposals, those kind of feel like state level things, Dr. Pond. I'm wondering what kinds of conversations are happening at the state level around that. And not just for people, who need paid sick leave for a COVID infection, but people with long COVID too.
Sure. I think on both levels, there's a lot of ongoing conversations. And just to speak to indoor air quality for a moment, it's definitely an important thing that can be a great gain and priority that's elevated after this pandemic. So there is an indoor air quality task force, and it is really looking at better coordination and looking at those long-term investments. And that's going to help us for, not only COVID and other respiratory diseases, but, as we have poor air quality due to wildfires or other air quality issues. So there are a lot of efforts going on with that. I think I admittedly am less up to speed on the latest conversations about sick leave, but I hope in general, too, that people are really have that message to really stay home when ill, to not spread disease to others. And thankfully, because of a lot of technology and other things, and not everyone has that choice, of course, but that there are more options to try to do some work remotely.
Well, this listener writes, I'm disappointed about how accepting of COVID so many people seem to be. I rarely see people wearing masks or keeping 6 feet away from people they do not know when standing in lines. When I am waiting in line at my local pharmacy or grocery, I choose to explain to people that I'm wearing my mask and trying to stay away from them because I have leukemia and my body cannot make antibodies against any disease, COVID and others. Karen writes, I've heard that there's a newer strain that the current antiviral meds don't work as well on. Is that true? Would they still help protect against long COVID? And what's the best source to follow daily death totals? I think we talked about this a little bit. Worldometer shows more like 200 to 300 Americans per day. There's a few questions there, but the first one first, Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, in terms of the newer strains, the current antiviral meds not working as well against them?
So the silver lining, Mina, is that all of the meds, Paxlovid, Molnupiravir, Remdesivir, they work on the virus factory and they prevent the factory from making more virus. So it doesn't matter what the spike protein looks like. So they are spike protein independent. So you can give me the scariest variant on Earth, and those drugs are still working, and they are still going to work. So that's a big takeaway point for everyone in the audience to know.
In that second part, Carly, in terms of the best source to follow daily death totals, I know you are our data person. Where do you turn to?
There's several trackers online. I believe the New York Times has a pretty robust one. But as we've seen with a lot of this stuff, a great deal was online in 2020 and then continued into 2021. And folks might find that the sources of information that they have been turning to over the last few years have kind of ebbed away. And so they might not be able to find this stuff online anymore.
Well, Dr. Pond, as a pediatrician, we're actually getting some questions that you might be able to help us out with related to pregnancy. Ravi writes, what are considerations if you're pregnant, trying to get pregnant or thinking about pregnancy? How should a pregnant woman stay safe? What are the current risks if you're boosted?
So for pregnancy, I think one of the most important things is to get vaccinated, actually, and be up to date on your COVID-19 and other vaccinations. So flu and COVID-19 and many other diseases can be more severe in pregnancy. And the great thing about vaccinations is many of them actually not only help benefit the pregnant woman, but also the fetus and infant. And we have more and more studies evolving around that for whooping cough, flu, that those antibodies can actually be transmitted to the infant and help protect them in those early months before they can develop their own antibodies and when they're too young to get vaccinated. And like sort of some of the other comments about, if you have various reasons for your immune system or medical problems, you can still wear a well-fitted, well-filtered mask in settings where you are either crowded indoor settings or other places where you're concerned you could be exposed.
We're talking with state epidemiologist Dr. Erica Pond, Deputy Director for the Center for Infectious Diseases at the State Department of Public Health. Also, Dr. Peter Chin-Hong of UCSF is with us, and Carly Severn of KQED. And you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Dr. Pond, the last time we had you on, public health officials were talking about the potential triple-demic and its severe impact, flu, RSV, and COVID, that would disproportionately affect kids as well as the elderly. How is the state assessing that risk now? Just curious as we start February.
Sure. We continue to, and actually sort of to answer one of the other questions too, public health is always tracking, monitoring respiratory surveillance and certainly COVID-19, and we'll continue to monitor. Certainly the cadence may decrease or, with flu, we monitor more closely during flu season. We're very confident at this point that flu and RSV have decreased. We're starting to see some other viruses circulate, which is, again, typical. And there are dozens of viruses that, don't even get tested for. But I think the other encouraging thing, and to the point about death, is when we've looked at combined respiratory deaths this past winter, they're actually not higher in the state of California than, for example, the really bad flu season in 2017-2018 of deaths from flu. So that is encouraging. I think, again, all the vaccinations and treatment and tools we have gained over the pandemic have really decreased the impact of this virus. And we, again, have gotten over this winter surge that we saw with the early flu and RSV seasons.
Leslie writes, please talk about testing. The testing centers are shutting down. Yes, we're certainly hearing that in different local jurisdictions with the state emergency declaration going away. Dr. Pond, what can you tell this listener about their concern about testing centers going away?
Sure. I think a lot of that is because tests are so much easier to get now. So you can get over-the-counter tests. They have thankfully gotten less and less expensive. And, that is, I think, a lot of things as far as funding of these things over time is going to evolve. And we're waiting to see more about that. Is one of the impacts of the ends of these emergencies is government funded, especially for people who are insured. We always look at things like, for example, with flu vaccine during the winter as well, we do have some allocations for kind of un and underinsured high-risk individuals. So over time, that may still be available. But I think really transitioning all of these sort of emergency-funded, government-funded healthcare resources are going to be transitioning to healthcare insurers and the private insurance systems. But again, it's really so much easier now to get over-the-counter tests and so the community sites will be changing, but getting over-the-counter tests should still remain easy.
Well, this person wrote to KQED's digital team, I had COVID twice in 1 year, early January and late December 2022. Fortunately, I didn't get acutely ill and have not been at risk of respiratory distress or hospitalization. However, each time, recovery was long. It took about a month before I was able to get through a regular workday. Brain fog, particularly word recall challenges, persisted through the year in between. If COVID becomes a fact of life like the annual flu season, it is possible that I'm at risk of losing a month of productivity out of each year. Dr. Chenong, what's the latest medical understanding of long COVID? How prevalent is what this person is describing?
Yeah, so every time I hear a story about people having post-infectious symptoms, I always, get a little bit more gray in my hair. And that's because it is sort of the elephant in the room. It is going to be the legacy of COVID for our lifetime, actually. And we have very little understanding still of therapeutic options, but we're getting more and more understanding about who gets it and how common it is. So I think one of the silver lining studies, I think, that came out in the last month or so shows that most people with chronic symptoms after COVID get better within a year, and that study came from Israel. So, but even if you think of that way, that still leaves a few million Americans who still have symptoms after a year. But for the listener who called in, I think it is common for people to have symptoms, even though it's not called long COVID officially. The WHO says at least three months of continued symptoms after onset. CDC says 2 months, but most people actually will have symptoms and will get better within a month. But it's not going to be like a regular virus. And I think that's the other reason why we just, we don't want to be fearful of the virus, but you certainly don't want to run and intentionally put yourself in the path of a lot of virus risk. So that's kind of what we know. We know that long COVID could be due to viral persistence or autoantibodies being produced or even effects on the microbiome or reactivation of other viruses. But it's probably a hodgepodge of different things. And we're still in the infancy of therapeutic options. But for people listening, if you think you have long COVID, recovercovid.org, you can Google it, is a good place to start for finding a support group and being enrolled in a study as we try to understand more, not only what we can do about it, but, all of the impact that it's having on this population.
Yeah, Dr. Chenong describes it as the legacy of COVID. We just have seconds left, but how is the state thinking about, I know that some people are eligible for disability and so on, but how to address and mitigate the effects of this legacy?
Yeah, I think as Dr. Chenong said, I think we're still kind of learning and ongoing evolving of this. But I think right now we've got some great collaborations with some of our partners, including UCSF, where Dr. Chenong is, and the UC health system in general, looking at long COVID, really trying to look at what are these long-term impacts. And I think there's a lot to learn, and I totally agree that this is the unfortunate legacy, but a lot of efforts happening with that.
Well, Dr. Pan, Dr. Chenong, Carly Severn, thank you for seeing us through this. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.